Welcome to The Mic Is On, episode 53, with Dr. Celeste Holbrook. Now, this episode is something that I have thought about how I'm going to describe to you on the intro, because it is so different than perhaps any other episode that we've had here on the Mic Is On podcast. The guest is Celeste Holbrook. Celeste is a sexologist, which you will hear plenty about. However, there's a whole story that needs to be gone through, because on this episode, we are going to talk about Celeste's brother, Devin Becker, who I was good friends with. And we're going to explain my relationship with Devin, how we got to know each other, how that intertwines with her and his relationship situation in life, and then tell the story about what happened to Devin. But then at the same time, we're telling Celeste's story as well, because what Celeste does now obviously didn't start out that way. And as many of the episodes do, we follow the person's path. Well, in this episode, we are going to follow Celeste's path, but we're talking Devin first. And I realize that when any of you listen to this podcast, for whatever reasons you may have, there's very different episodes out there. This is one of them. But I beg you, not beg, urge, hope that you will listen. Because the first part is talking about someone who was obviously very important to both of us and extremely important to her because it was her brother. But it all plays a part in the entire episode. Now, also, if you're used to listening to podcasts that always talk about the same exact things over and over, this is definitely a change from that, because topics that are heavily covered in here are death, grief, and then sex stuff. Now, it's not inappropriate. It is definitely different. We end up talking about, you know, the importance of health and things like that in school. But I am just telling you this. If you'll just take me at my word, give this episode a chance. Whether you knew Devin before, and most of you don't know him at all, but you will know him better, and you'll for sure know Celeste better, and you might even know me better at the end. So do it for the holiday season. It's episode 53 with Celeste Holbrook here on The Mic Is On. All right, today I am here with officially Dr. Celeste Holbrook. However, this interview is going to be anything but official. It's going to be different than anything I've done previously on the podcast, because we're kind of merging things together. But I want to introduce Celeste as what she is, as she is officially a sexologist, and I believe the first that we've had here on the podcast. But yet, if you're listening to this, don't think that's the whole story, because it's not. But I want to welcome Celeste to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
Hi, Mike. That's a lovely question. You know what? When you're in like this, in this field, and I get the privilege of listening a whole lot, which is really lovely. And it's so nice to be asked how I'm doing. I am doing really great today. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm doing good. As you know, we are on a break right now, a little Thanksgiving break as we're recording this. So as teachers, it's just like your one small break before you get back into it as you lead up to Christmas, winter break. So it's good. I love the Thanksgiving season, and I am, pun intended, giving thanks that you are here on the podcast, because you are somebody that came up on a podcast from Janelle Tay when she mentioned your name. And she goes, "Hey, you know, don't you? I think you know her." And I was like, "Well, who?" And she's like, "Celeste Holbrook." And I go, "Okay." She goes, "Actually, her maiden name was Becker." I go, "Oh yeah, I know her." I said, and I said on the podcast, I said, "And I know her brother. I was good friends with her brother."
Yeah.
So this is the onus of where we want to start today. Your name, of course, as I just said, was Celeste Becker. You had a brother, Devin Becker, who I intersected with at a point in my life when I first left college. And I want to start today by first hearing you give your first impression. Now, I know this is very different, but your brother, Devin, what first comes to mind when you think of him? Because then I'm going to break you into how our relationship got started. So when you think of your brother, Devin, what is the first few things that come to your mind?
Big personality, very goofy, very talented, pretty stubborn, and kind. Those are the things that I think of. Yeah.
Kindness definitely is one of them. And that was something I wrote down on a piece of paper yesterday, just the things I remember about Devin. Now, let me explain how Devin came to my life initially. So I went to Southwestern Adventist University, which I've discussed here before. I graduated from college in 1997, which is before, is a while back. You know, it's been a while.
I mean,
When I graduated from college, I had heard the name Devin Becker at some point living around in Keene and knowing that he was somewhat related to somebody who I dated in college for a couple of years. But I got a job in Hawaii and I went to work at a radio station, a sports radio station, in the summer of 97 out in Honolulu. Now, crazily enough, Hawaiian Mission Academy, which is an Adventist high school, I think it's still there, they normally will have 2 to 3 people each year come into that school to work as, whether it's on campus or in the kitchen, they depend on people from the mainland to come out there to help.
Yeah.
So someone that I knew also was out there that year, going to be out there that year. And then I heard, oh, yeah, and I don't remember where I first heard it. Oh, yeah, Devin Becker, this guy. And I was like, wait, I know who that is. I don't know him a lot, but I know who he is. I think I'd met him once before. So I'm like, this is awesome because I'm literally moving out to Hawaii to work at a radio station. I don't obviously have any established friends there. I have cousins and stuff like that in other parts of the island. But I was like, this is awesome. So I don't remember exactly when, but I got there in June or May, Memorial Day weekend. And I think that Devin and the other people showed up like in July and at some point. And so is essentially that school year for the time that I stayed there is where our relationship like blossomed. We were very close friends. We did all kinds of stuff together because it wasn't like he had friends out there too. But that is where my relationship with Devin was at. And I ended up leaving in February. So it was literally like 6 months there. Yeah. And then beyond that, when I went back to Texas, we talked a little bit, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second. But that was where it initially happened. Now, I asked you about Devin earlier. What do you remember about him going to Hawaii?
I was young. If that was 97, you know, I was a sophomore in high school. And what I actually remember was we did go to visit him in Hawaii. And I remember him. I remember thinking like, oh, my brother's like in charge of people. Like this is bananas. Like he's like taking these kids surfing and he's like in charge of people and he looks so responsible. But also I don't know if you remember this, but he had a moped. Like he didn't have a car. He bought a moped and he would carry his longboard on the moped, but the longboard was like 200 feet long. It was so huge. He's a big dude. He needed a huge longboard and he would carry it. And this is just like normal for Hawaii. He would just like carry it on his moped down the beach. And I remember thinking like, this is the silliest thing. And also I've always been in awe of my brother. He's my older brother. Right. And I wanted to be like him. And so that's what I just thought. I'm like, he's in charge of people. That's kind of strange. Cause I don't typically think of him as like a person in charge. but also everybody loved him. Everybody was just like, Devin's the coolest, you know? So I was like, okay, yeah, great.
And his personality, as I got to know him, like we had a lot of things in common. And what I didn't know about Devin at that time, having just gotten to really get close to him in Hawaii, was I am a person also who, when I'm around you, I'm fully in, right? Like if I'm there, we're fully in, but yet when I'm away or you're away, I'm okay if the person isn't calling me, right? Like okay if we're not like always talking. And of course that was before social media really, I mean, it was just starting back then. But I did not know that about Devin either at that point, that he was very much the same way, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
You're around him. We're locked in. Let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's do this. So he was very much a person of the moment. Mm. And one of the stories I remembered about Devin was he invited me to come work out. Like, they had this like old like weight machine stuff there at the academy. And yeah. It was, let's see, curl machine. It was a curl machine. And Devin was big, bigger than I was. And I hadn't been working out with weights, obviously, in months because I had just gotten out there. And I remember him one day, he was like, come on, you know, we're doing this. And I was like, Devin, I can't do as much as you, man. I'm not trying to max out. He's like, nah, you can, come on, you can do it. You can do it. So he's like pumping me up. And so we're just doing curls on a machine.
Yeah.
But when you do curls on a machine, when you get sore the next day or the next multiple days,
right?
Because it's in the bend of your elbow, because when you're extending off the end, if you extend and it's too much weight pulling, that's where it tends to hurt. So I remember I was doing this with Dev, and we're doing that, and literally, I think I had torn my bicep. Like, I don't think I actually did tear it, but the 2-3 days afterwards, I literally couldn't straighten my arm up. And I was like, I'm never doing this again, Devin. And he's like, oh, man, it's too bad. You know, like, I'm like, yeah, I can't straighten my arm. But it was one of the things that was coming to me, and I was just remembering how he thought it was so funny. And I was like, dude, I can't straighten my arm. It's because of doing too much weight, because you're pushing me, and I'm, you know.
Yeah.
But it's things like that that come to mind. And, you know, I feel lucky because he was my closest, you know, like I say, I was a friendship that was born out of being away from a lot of other people. And we spent a lot of time together. And this is the other thing. So when I was there, I said I worked at a sports radio station. And it was called 760 KGU, The Ball. And as you may know, and I'll tell everybody else out there, Devin was great at sound effects, different voices, and loved drums, loved percussion like me. I also was percussionist in high school and even some in college. So, but he loved doing like mouth, you know, voices of songs.
Yep.
So when I would do my sports reports at KGU, all the sports reports would start with a doom, ksh, doom, ksh, and then I would come in and say 760 KGU, The Ball. So it got to the point where Devin would call me and he'd be like, hey man, just put the phone down. Just put the phone down, because, and for whatever reason, he wouldn't be listening on the air, but he would like want me to put the phone down in the studio. So I would do the report and he would just listen to me doing it. But then after that, he would, at any point when I would talk to him, he would go, okay. And whenever I talked to him on the phone, whether I was in Texas and he was back in Hawaii, or whether I was in Texas and he was in Ohio, wherever, he would go, hey, Mike, doom, doom. And he expected me to then go 760 KGU, The Ball. And like literally every time we talked. And I'll never forget that. It was the greatest thing, because anytime we would talk, he would go, hey, hold on. Hey,
that's exactly right.
And then I would do the voice and I like the thing. So
oh man,
it's stuff like that that brings me so much.
That is so hit. I mean, like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, it would bring him so much joy to, like, you know, get somebody to do their thing. Like, he was into people's things. If you had a thing, if you had a call, if you had a whatever, he was like, I want to get them to do their thing. You know, that's awesome.
And we also had a shared caring and love at that point in our lives of Howard Stern. So we had both been listening to him when we were living in Texas, even though we didn't know each other there. And so we would do like voices from that show a lot and annoy other people, specifically the other people that were working at the academy that year, because he would say something in a voice and he was like, say, I think though. And then and then I would say something. And of course, yes, we're both in I was my early 20s. He was like 19, I think, then, or somewhere around that range. Yeah. But yeah, so I remember multiple things about that year. And when I came back to Texas, because I actually went back to the college to work there for the next year and a half, we would stay in touch on the phone. And then he eventually came back to Texas as well, which leads to the only time I think I went to your guys' house.
Oh,
there was one time where he I don't remember what we went there for. It was around the holidays. I went over there for some reason. He's like, hey, come over. And then this is, so he goes, yeah, Celeste is, he was talking about you, and he opens it. You're like in a room, in your bedroom, maybe. And I can't remember if there was someone else in there with you or something like that. And it was like, hey, Celeste, of course, you know how he would like, just, he didn't care
make
what
an you were entrance.
Doing. He's going to open the door. And I was remembering, hey, how you doing? You know, and that was the one time I went to your guys' house actually out there. But I say all this to kind of let you know, like, this is how I remember Devin, right? So then, you know, there was that the year in Hawaii, but then literally every time after that phone thing I was talking about, it didn't matter when I talked to him. That was 100% coming out. Now, Devin comes back to Texas. You're still in Texas. You're going to college as well. Mm-hmm. Just before we started, I was telling you that I left Texas to come back to California in the summer of 2000, which is when you graduated. Now, he also had been going, he went up to Ohio, right? He was, he lived in Ohio.
Yep.
Throughout your college experience, you know, what was your relationship with him like? Because, of course, yeah, he was a little bit older, and he listen, your brother was a wanderer, right? Like, he would literally.
That's correct.
Okay, hey, I'm going here. Okay, yeah. And maybe your family knew, maybe they didn't. It, you know, it was like, hey,
that's
this is
accurate.
What I'm doing. So, what that's do you accurate. Remember about like your college experience and your guys' relationship during those years?
Yeah, well, he was wandering right when I was in college, and so we were 5 years apart, and so that's a significant gap when you're younger. When you're five and your brother is 10, right? Or you're 10 and your brother's 15. But when you're 20 and your brother's 25, it's not as much of a gap anymore. And so I remember us when he was home, and sometimes he lived at home. Sometimes he lived in Dallas. He lived in Ohio. But when we would see each other, as I got older, it was more like, oh, I saw him be real with me instead of like, I wasn't the annoying little sister anymore. And, you know, I think that's when we got to be more close. Was when I was in college, and I think things turned actually when he got back from Hawaii. And I remember him coming in, and I was really excited to see him. And I was different, right? I was growing up. I went from like 15 to 16, and you just, you know, you're growing up as a kid. And he came home and he was like, well, you grew up. I was like, well, I didn't know what to say. I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, I don't know what to say to that, but that's when things turned where we could be comrades, you know, we could kind of talk about things. And he would talk to me about boys a little bit, like, well, you know, you're dating this guy, like, well, what is he like or whatever. And he's got to be a little bit more interested in my life, I think. And so we got to be pretty close, through college, just when he was home and things like that. And we would talk to each other a little bit on the phone, but you were right in that Devin was the epitome of presence, right? If you're in his presence, he's with you 100%, right? And also if you're not with him, like out of sight, a little bit out of mind. And that's, to be honest, the more I get older, like that's a beautiful way to live.
It is.
So yeah, we got closer as I was in college and, you know, going through some college kind of stuff. And I, looking back, I wish that I had understood more about like disability, understood more about epilepsy, and really understood probably why he wandered so much and why things were hard for him. I was just a kid. I didn't understand it. I thought it was just this thing that he had, you know? And so that's one of my biggest sadnesses, is that I didn't have as much compassion for it as I probably should have, growing up, for sure.
Well, and that is a precursor to a couple of questions I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I met him or really got to know him. Like I say, he's just before he's 20, right? Or mm-hmm. right around that range. So I didn't see him in childhood. I didn't see him even in his young teenage years. So I got an idea of how he was, but it's different when you're meeting someone at those certain points in life, right? Everything is what your perception is. Okay, I met this person at this age. This is what I know of them. And I didn't know, which we'll talk about as we lead up, anything about any condition. Right. You know, nothing was mentioned, of course. And so that's why later on, I was like, what the? I had no idea. Right. But I did know about his wandering and his frustration sometimes. And I would be like, Dev, like, what's the deal? Like, are you – I remember having a conversation, in fact, on the phone where he was – I think he was in Ohio when this happened. Because literally, you no telling where anywhere. He was when you're talking. And I was like, well, why – asking him why he was upset or frustrated, because he was explaining some frustration. He's like, I just don't know. You know, like – you know, he didn't go, he wouldn't get deep into necessarily talking about like, oh, this is really bothering me. You're just, I'm just fed up with it or whatever it was. The other thing I do remember when you're mentioning about him being present is if you tried to get to him on the phone, like you could leave, I could leave multiple messages, right? Like, you'd be like, hey man, call me. We'll talk at this time. Okay, great. So I call, leave a message. Call him, and I might hear back from him like 5 days later. But when he calls, I'm not frustrated about it at all. It's just like, hey, we're locked in. Even though I'm like, Dev, where were you? I was busy. I had stuff, you know. Like that was what appealed to me also, because I also knew that he wasn't going to take it personally if I wasn't right in touch with him. But it was always whenever we talked, we knew we were joking about Hawaii. We knew we were joking about, you know, different things. Now, you mentioned a little bit about stuff that had happened to him or he had earlier in his life that you didn't fully understand. So take us through just a little bit about what his situation kind of was, because there wasn't something that was evident. Like I say, I'm perceptive, but we never had a talk about anything that he had gone through like that. So what do you remember and what were things that you wish you knew more now? Like when you explain that, what specifically are you referring to?
Right. So Devin had a grand mal seizures, basically, which make you pass out and you have tremors. And you kind of don't know what's going on until you come to again. And we're pretty scary. But he didn't have them from birth. His first one was when he was 12 and happened when he was he had been playing video games with his friend Isaac for a long time, you know, like a 12-year-old would, right? And so something about the lights in the screen kind of triggered this seizure. And it was very, I was at the house and I remember the paramedics, my parents calling the paramedics and them coming around. And I remember when he came to, I think the paramedics were wearing like white scrubs or something like that. And he thought he was in heaven, which was kind of funny at the time, but, or funny now, not at the time, but, you know, my parents protected me a great deal of what was going on. I'm sure, like being a parent now, I'm like, oh my God, that must've been so scary. Right. But they pretty much protected me. He went through a lot of testing and eventually was able to get on some medication that was helpful, gabapentin and things like that. So he was able to regulate it to some degree, like stay off the certain kinds of screens. Like they got him a computer that had a certain type of screen on it. He had to get enough sleep. He had sleep apnea. So that, can trigger seizures sometimes. And he couldn't like drink alcohol. I mean, we weren't supposed to be drinking anyway, but that would kind of trigger it, or like too much coffee or things like that. So they started to understand what would happen. He would also get auras. So before you have a seizure, his type of epilepsy, he would start to look kind of funny, or like, I feel like I'm having an aura. And sometimes he could get to a spot where he was safe. So in total, I don't know exactly how many he ever had in his whole life, but not a ton. Like I want to say in the 10 to 12 range, 10 to 12 seizures his whole life, which is very difficult, right? Because, you know, when you're getting your driver's license, you have to disclose things like that. And is it regulated? And, you know, is he going to have a seizure while he's driving? So it was really tough. I think really tough for my parents. And I wish I would have, I mean, I was a kid. I obviously give myself a lot of compassion, but I wish I would have understood more about how hard that was, right? Because if you think about going to school and you're on the school computers, and what if you're going to have an episode of seizure there? Or, you know, he didn't want to disclose it to people he was dating. Like, is that going to scare them off? Right. And so I just wish I would have had more compassion for it. I thought it was like, oh, something that happens and it's not really a big deal, because nobody really talked to me about it. And I think everybody else in my family was a little bit like, we're just trying to figure this out. But to kind of breadcrumb that into, I think that's why he wandered so much. I think that's why he lived in the present so much, because it was difficult to think about a future where he would have one of these episodes where he would have a seizure again. And so I think that made him like, you know what, I'm going to just like do the things, live the life that I want and ask questions later.
Yeah. When you were talking about that, about the driving part, like literally, so when you're in Hawaii, like when he's in Hawaii, that's half the thing, right? When you're working there, you're driving a van with students every week, multiple times a week, you're doing all kinds of things. And so now thinking about those things, like we never had this discussion. Like
we had
a lot of wild discussions and I was like, sure. Man, I don't remember ever talking about that or him mentioning it, of course. And not that I would expect him to, but there were moments of vulnerability or things like that. But it, like I say, when you're that young still, yeah. Like, right, you're like 20, it's hard to think big picture, right? It's hard to think big picture at 30, but it's hard right. at 20 to think that way. But I completely understand what you're saying is it's hard to also imagine like, shoot, if this is happening or if this happens randomly, how can I ever achieve normalcy, right? So I don't know if that, you know, do you remember him ever having a conversation with you about it?
Not really specifically. I was around for some of them, or like, I remember being in the house and him saying, I don't feel good. I don't feel good. I think I need to sit down. Like him having an aura and kind of collapsing and me running to go get help. Like, I remember them happening. He just didn't talk very much about it. And I wish he would have. There's a lot of regret, you know, that you can think about, hindsight's 2020, but I think he would have been so supported by his family, by his friends and family, of course, maybe even more if he could have talked about it more, you know, but he never really talked about it with me much, other than having maybe one conversation about him going to art. He went to the Dallas Art Institute for a little bit, like for computer aided design or something like that. And he had a seizure at school and just quit. He just never went back. He just unenrolled. And he had a conversation with me about like how frustrating that was. Like, I remember being in the car with him and being like, he was like, I just can't do anything. I don't, you know, his like frustration voice. Like, I just can't, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. Like what, like, I can't do anything basically. And like me being like, I don't know. I don't know how to help, you know?
Yeah. So here's a question for you. You're in college from 2000 to 2004, right? Now at that point, what were you thinking you were going to be doing after college?
I went into college thinking I was going to be a teacher. Both of our parents are teachers, and that seemed like a really great way to have summers off. So that's what I knew. So I thought maybe teaching English, like my mom, or teaching some sort of health, which is what I went to school for. So I have a degree in health education from Southwestern, and I'm practical to a fault. So I was like, if I could be a health teacher and maybe like exercise at work, then I wouldn't have to exercise after work. This is like my logic. This is like my 21-year-old logic. Right. I could exercise at work, that way I wouldn't have to exercise after work. And so, yeah, that's what I'm interested in, health. I'm really interested in behaviors, which served me well, you know, throughout my life up until now. So I was really interested in why people do what they do, like why some people choose this and other people choose that. Right. So that's what essentially why I chose health education in college. And I think at Southwestern at the time, it was called wellness. But that was really why. Is like, I was really interested more in behaviors. Like why do people do the things that they do? I was really interested in anatomy. I loved anatomy, and I loved exercise physiology and exercise science, that kind of thing.
And I ask that because when your brother went to Ohio, right? Like it was Ohio State, and I can't remember who he was living with up there. It was friends that he went up there with, right? Like he,
So Jeff Adams, who you maybe know or not, from Keene, moved up there. He was just like, "Hey, Jeff, you want to move to Ohio?" And Jeff was like, "Okay," and just like got packed and left. I think had one day of notice. He also lived with a guy named Matt Blatensky and Brian Kirk. So they were all living up in this big, like, weird condo.
Okay, so I never got to visit, of course, but I talked to him plenty of times when he was there. And this brought the school thing. This is all playing in. I remember thinking, okay, so you're going to Ohio State. Like, you're going to Ohio State. He was like, well, and I was like, oh, okay, so you're not going to Ohio State. And then I want to say, wasn't he working in a bakery? It was a
Sammy's Bagels.
There was a bakery or bagel shop. So I remember talking to him there. And so whenever I would talk to him in Ohio, I remember always thinking, like, okay, so what are you doing now? You know, like, and it would be different. But it was just, I'll never forget when he went there and I was like, oh, okay, so you're going to, I guess you're going to Ohio State. And he's like, well,
that was like a loose interpretation of what was happening. I'm at Ohio State. I don't know that I'm attending classes or enrolled, but.
And, right. That's the other thing is I was going to say for your brother, like you said, you're practical to a fault. Your brother was definitely not the school going type.
No.
And not in a manner of not bright enough, I mean, he was extremely awesome as far as his ability to understand people and to create positive relationships with anybody he met, like literally anybody he met. But he definitely was not the school going type.
Nope.
Like,
nope.
Disliked it. Wasn't big on turning stuff in. I remember he was like, "That guy, you need to come on." You know, that was even talking about high school, like his high school thing. Like, yes. I remember telling him, like, "Hey, I hard enough that I got through," like basically saying he couldn't believe he got to Hawaii. Because, you know, high school. So in saying that, like, part of that is interesting to me because you're already stating that your personality, your style is so different than his was.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And when you think about that now, was that something that you bore out of, like, okay, I see him not really organized. I am going to be organized, or just it was natural?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. When you're 5 years apart, I feel like, you know, how you have sibling order things and some, you know, the firstborn is like lots of times more like the directed one and takes care of things. Like, that was not our experience. I feel like I grew up with definitely I'm a good girl syndrome. I'm a pleaser. I want all the adults in my life to like me and be pleased with my behavior. Right. And I don't want to cause conflict. Right. I'm an Enneagram 9, if anybody does Enneagram. So I didn't want to raise conflict. And I knew from a young age, like, especially when Devin first had a seizure, that I just needed to be okay. Like, I needed to not cause trouble because, Devin needed more than I did. Right. And I wasn't cognizant about that as like a 7-year-old, but over time I knew like I needed to get my stuff together. Right. And keep it together. And that served me really, really well, but it people pleasing creates some problems later on down the road. But yeah, I was straight A, you know, student and did the things and followed all the directions and did not have as much fun as my brother did probably. And I'm trying to rectify that as an adult.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And that is next up, but I want to talk now. The reason we talked about Devin and I look at this, like it's my ode to somebody who I cared about, who I don't get the opportunity to interview. Cause let me tell you something, you talk about wild episodes. It would be unbelievable. take me, you know, as what you remember, about the 2009, cause I believe it was 2009. I was in California. I had been teaching for a few years. So when I would talk to Devin, it was like once every few months, maybe 5 or 6 months, you know? So we were talking once a year, twice a year, but still, like, I still felt like we're locked in. What exactly the situation that happened? I don't know any of the intricate details, but as much as you feel comfortable sharing, what actually happened that took Devin away?
Mm. So I'm going to preface this by, like, I will tear up and cry about this, but I am okay. Like, I definitely am okay with that because grief is the receipts we have for love. And so I'm always okay with it. It makes, I think when you get emotional talking about something that's really important to you, sometimes it can make other people uncomfortable, like make you uncomfortable or whatnot, which I know you can handle no problem. But I stopped apologizing for my grief like probably 5 years ago because I'm literally in the work of vulnerability, right? And so it is part of my job as a human and as a sexologist to take the first step of vulnerability in a lot of different ways. And I've never talked about Devin on a podcast before. This is the very first thing. But I feel very excited. So despite like, that's a very tough question to answer, I'm very honored and happy to answer it. Right. So I just want you to know that first. So in 2009, I was married. I still am married. I had been married for a couple of years. We were living in Missouri, actually, in Kirksville, Missouri, where my partner, my husband, was in medical school. I was finishing a PhD and teaching at Truman State University. So I had a teaching job there, which I loved. And so March of 2009, I was at a friend's house. And she was telling me all about this guy she was dating. And I had the Nokia flip phone, like the little, the little one. And my dad kept calling. And I really wanted to be present for this friend of mine that I was listening to her story. And so I just thought it was really weird. He kept calling. So eventually when I was leaving, Nate actually called me. Nate's my husband, soul Nate. And Nate calls me and he says, I'm coming to pick you up from Maureen's house. So I said, oh, okay. And he was like, can you just stay there for a second? I said, okay. And so I knew something was up and I got in the car. I did not call my dad back. I got in the car with Nate and Nate said, babe, something's happened with your brother. And I was like, is he okay? You know? And he says, no, he's not okay. You know, you go into shock. You've been through this process before. You go into shock and, you know, my first immediate thought was call daddy because, I was scared for my parents, you know, like, are they okay? Do they have people there to help them? You know? So I called daddy and my dad's cousin was there with him and they were all together and I knew somebody would be spending the night at the house with them. And, so that was the day we go, you know, there's days in your life that split your life in half or quarters or whatever it is. You have those two. And so that was the day. That was the day that changed that, you know, things were different from then on. And so, yeah, he was in his apartment. He was working at Starbucks and he was getting up for his morning shift and just had a seizure that stopped his heart. According to the coroner, no foul play or anything like that, but had a seizure that stopped his heart. And his roommate, he had a roommate that he didn't know very well. He was living with somebody he didn't really know very well. His roommate found him and called the ambulance and he had already passed away. He passed away pretty quickly. And so his roommate actually didn't know what to do and called the only person that he knew was like a friend of my brother's that he had his information on, which happens to be my ex-boyfriend, which they stayed friends and Matt is his name. And he was living in California with his wife. And actually the roommate called Matt. And this is something that I am forever grateful for to Matt, who we aren't talking terms or whatever, but I'm forever grateful. Matt was the one who actually had to call my parents and tell them what had happened. And I just feel like that's just such an awful thing to have to do. And I'm super forever grateful that he was able to do that and not, you know, somebody that they didn't know very well. So that was kind of how it happened. It was such a surprise. So unnerving. And there are also some beautiful things. He wasn't out surfing. Like he didn't lose his body anywhere. He wasn't driving. He didn't hurt anybody else or, you know, he wouldn't have caused that, but nobody else got hurt when he passed. And so yeah, that was the moment. Right after that, in the summer of 2009, we were actually moving for Nate's residency. And so, or his, like the last 2 years of his medical school and residency. And so we moved to Columbus. So one of the hardest things I remember is meeting new people and being in a new place and then asking about my family and me being like, I don't want to talk about this. You know, I don't want to like, first of all, I don't know you very well. I'm very tender about this thing and I don't want to cry in front of you. And, you know, so it was really weird, a weird thing to be in a new place, learning new people. And they're just going to ask about your family. Like, hey, where are your friend? Where's your friend? You have siblings? Da, da, da. So that was like a weird thing, you know, among a lot of different things that were weird about it. But yeah, that's kind of the story. I don't know if that fills in any gaps for you as far as like what kind of happened, you know, that day.
No, you know, I have to remember that not everyone's listened to this podcast before. You know, I, having done an episode talking about my father, who had passed away less than 2 years before that. So it was December of 07, you know, knowing the feelings and every situation, I think this is the thing with death that you can't understand till you've been through it in some sort, is that every single situation is so different, right? Mm-hmm. If you're outside of it, you just go, okay, hey, that person died. Hey, that person passed away. But when you're in it, your situation that you go through with family members or friends or whatever is so distinctly different than any other situation. And then the other part about dealing with death or grief is that everybody is so different when it comes to what happens after, right? And that's been something that's been interesting for me since my father passed away, is when other people, friends, family members that I know, I always wonder, like, how are they doing? How do they deal with this? How does it go through? How I found out was I was walking in a Knob Hill in San Ramon, because that's where I was still living then. Steve Stafford, who you know very well, had, I can't remember if I took the call or if he had left me a message. I think I took the call because I was like, what? Why does this number call me?
Kind of odd, yeah.
And he told me that Devin had passed away. He had a seizure. And in my mind, I was like, seizure, what the heck? Like
out of blue. Yeah. It feels like out of the blue for you.
How is this? And I just remember it like hitting me so sudden. He's so young. What? And my first reaction was literally to call Andrea, who had been out in Hawaii that same year, who I'd known, to just let her know, hey, here's what happened, right?
Yeah.
And I even remember telling Stafford, as I call him Stafford, I said, hey, you know, let her family know, more your mom and dad, like if they, this was afterwards, this wasn't like that day.
Yeah.
If they ever want to ask me questions about Devin or hear funny stories about him, let them know that I'm more than willing, because I know I love talking about my father. And even after he passed away, like it still brings me joy. Whether I cry or not, it brings me joy, right? I love it. And because I know that he made an impact. And Devin was so similar in that fact that he impacted everybody he met, no matter what. So I remember saying to him, like, hey, you know, if they ever have any questions about, like, hey, because obviously they weren't in Hawaii the whole time. You weren't in Hawaii the whole time.
Right.
Like today is really the first time I've ever told any of those stories. Like, who else am I going to tell the story about that? Who am I going to tell that to? Like, hey, let me tell you about this story. But I remember that. And so this is where, when I found out what you are doing now, it immediately made me think of Devin. Mm-hmm. And stuff I haven't told you about yet is like when he would talk about boys liking his sister, or like, oh, I'm gonna kill these guys if they try to, you know, they like he would say stuff like that to me. That's we would hilarious. Laugh and stuff like that. But you mentioned something about incidents that change your life forever, and literally that nothing is ever the same from that point on. It doesn't mean that things fall apart. It just, it's never the same for you. When you, because you were already in school, right? You were already on your way, right, to doing what you're doing now. So Devin was at least aware of that, right?
Yeah. So I was getting my PhD in essentially public health education. So I had not, like, after I graduated, I started to do postgraduate work in sexual behavior. So at that point, no, he didn't know before he died that I would be in the field of sexology. However, you know, and this is like take it or leave it, right? Listen, I will try anything once. And so I have been to a tarot card reader. and she did I went to Bali with Alicia, Stafford's daughter. We went to Bali. We were on like this surf yoga retreat in Bali, and they offered up tarot card readings. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do one. I ain't scared. So I do this tarot card reading in Bali. And she said, well, I'm flipping this card, and this is a sibling card, right? And then she's like, okay, pick another number. So I pick another number. She flips through the cards to that number. And she was like, well, your sibling has a message for you. And it is that they are laughing. And she's like, looking at me like, are you okay with this? Like, they're laughing. And they want you to know that they think your career is funny. And they want you to know. And then she was like, she paused and she was like, do you work with women? I was like, yeah, I do. That's my whole thing. And I didn't tell her what I did at all. And she was like, well, for some reason he's laughing. He thinks it's funny, but he's proud of you. And so I was like, well, that tracks, that tracks. So whatever anybody believes, you know, I have deconstructed a lot of my beliefs from growing up, but I do feel like on some level, if there's a wrinkle in times, you know, if his soul or his spirit is somewhere, he is proud of me and he does find it funny, which I think is appropriate that I talk to people about sex.
So when I was reintroduced to what you do from Janelle, I went to Instagram, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But on Instagram, I watched, I don't know, 3 or 4 videos of you that you do. And I'm laughing.
Yeah,
and
good.
I'm laughing. And I was like, Devin, I thought he would, first of all, he would be so proud. He would be so proud. And I also thought, like, he also wouldn't believe this, because I remember him having these conversations like, oh, these guys, look at my sister. Oh, they're dead. They're dead. And to think that, like, it got to that, and just to see his quirkiness, right? Like, his sense of humor, and the fact that we would talk about, obviously, like, juvenile sense of humor stuff.
Of course, yeah.
Then to see the your stuff where you're holding devices and holding different things or waving them around, like, I literally was like, he would be so happy. And I know for many families that would be not the reaction, right? Or whatever. But that was my first thought. And that's where I was like, man, I would love to talk to Celeste sometime, right? Like, that it was all the worlds coming together, but I know he would be. And, you know, it's so awesome. I think it's great no matter what, but knowing the traumatic situation with Devin, knowing the family history, for darn sure he'd be proud.
I think he'd be a little mortified, like, oh, I don't want to think about my sister having sex or like talking about sex or you know, he's like, he'd be like mortified, but also like, oh yeah, like be pretty confident and like can handle her own in a room full of men, and like, you know, she doesn't, you know, need saving. So I think that he'd be proud about that.
for sure. Now let's talk about the change that happens from that point, right? Like, so this situation happens, like you said, you at that point were living in Missouri. The next year, how was it for you family wise? Cause it's hard, cause you can't, you know, you weren't like around them every single day all the time, but that year after, did you have times where you're like, okay, I should make a big adjustment, or were you just trying to keep everything level headed, even keel for your family? What do you remember about the next year?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, we were locked in school. Like, we, you know, taking out all the loans to get a PhD, and he was getting a DO, he was becoming a doctor. And so we were in it. Like, we couldn't move back. We couldn't really we didn't have any other options other than to finish what we had started. And that's what, you know, our family would want to do anyway. But mom and dad and I did have this conversation, not right away, but at some level, some point in the year, what can we do to honor Devin? You know, what would he want us to do? Like, now we're just like these islands floating out without him. And he was kind of like the big, like, universal force that kept us all laughing. Like, what do we do without him? You know, on a very practical level, like, what do we do? And so we decided, mom, dad, and I decided that we would all commit to living our lives one third. So we would basically, Devin's energy was too much for all of us to take on, right? So we committed to each taking a third of his energy and living our life more intentional and taking more risks. So whatever that meant for all of us, you know, I think, you know, my parents were teaching and maybe they took on more classes, or my mom definitely wanted to travel more. So she started traveling more with daddy. And I didn't know what that meant for me. We were poor, broke. We were broke as a joke. We were, you know, getting these degrees that we believed in, but also it was super tough. We were newly married. We lived in a, you know, place that we didn't have any friends yet. And it was a recession. So 2009, like I could not find a job for the life of me. I could not find a job. So I was working toward a PhD, I had a master's degree, and I finally got a job making $8.50 at a dog food store. And so I was like, well, I don't know if this is some kind of joke, but at least I could take my lab to work. So I was like, okay, I can take my dog to work. I'm going to sling dog food until I can find something else, because, you know, that's what's available to me. I'm going to take it. And I loved that job. It was so fun. It was what I needed, I think, at the time. Like, it didn't take a lot of mental energy. Just like, I could be there. I could not talk to anybody. I could literally stack dog food, you know, these 40-pound dog food bags with my dog there, talk to people about their dogs and go home. You know, I didn't have to grade papers. I didn't have to do whatever. So I got this dog food job, and I had it until, and this is where I think like the worlds collide. My brother passed away on March 21st of 2009. On March 21st of 2010, I had a job interview for a sex toy company, and they're looking for a health educator to train their consultants about the toys and about sex in general. And I was just like, listen, I will try anything once. I bet I can teach this. I know about behavior. So I know I can teach about sex behaviors. I go in, I think about my brother right before I go in. I'm like in the process of grief and excitement because I finally got a job interview after 9 months of working at the dog food store. And I go in, I'm thinking about Devin. I'm like, okay, Devin would go in here and he would just act like he had all the knowledge in the world and he would get this job because that was who Devin was. Like he could just do anything. He could convince anybody of anything. I was like, I'm going to use that energy. I'm going to go in here. I'm going to effing get this job, right? Because I need it so bad and I wanted it. And lo and behold, they hired me on the spot. Like I knocked my interview out of the park. I had everything lined up exactly what I needed to do. I had like projects to show them of like ways I was a great sex educator or a great health educator. And the girl who was interviewing me, her name is Erin, and she ended up being one of my very, very best friends now. But she hired me on the spot. So that was what started my career. Exactly a year to the day after Devin died, I got this job in health education, sex education. And that's kind of where it began.
And where was this at?
This is in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
Well, we were living in Columbus. The job was actually in Cincinnati. So I was driving 92 miles one way for this job, but listen, I was happy to have a job.
Okay. So I have questions about that day. Once you get it, your husband, your mom, your dad, yeah. When you tell them, hey,
yeah.
I got it.
Yeah.
Like everyone's reaction is going to be different right now. Of course they know you have interest in that area and they yeah. probably knew you had the interview, but what do you remember about what's the reaction for your family on awesome? Yeah. What? Yeah.
I think they were all very, very supportive and very excited. I don't remember exactly. I think they were happy I had a job in my field. Like it was still in health education. It was specifically sex education, but it was still in health education. Like I got it. I got the interview through my, through NCHEC, which is like the organization that I was a part of as a health educator. And so I think everybody was just thrilled that I had a job, not knowing, you know, what exactly that I'd be like slinging dildos like for the next couple of years. But I think everybody was really, really thrilled and really excited. And my poor husband was like in residency. I think he was like, oh, you got it. Okay. I'm going to go to sleep now.
So then from that point, see, this is where my interest as far as like, there's so many questions I have. So like you get this job, what's the day to day of that job? Right. Like, so, because you said they wanted you to be able to explain to their employees. So then, okay, they say, all right, you're hired. All right. What happens after that? Because is there like a training? Are there training? Like, you know what I mean? Like, in other words, how do you go from the yes, you have it to, okay, well, now just start. What does that consist of, and how did they get you to that point? Or did they just assume, she knows, she'll be great.
Yeah.
You know,
she'll be great. There was quite a bit of training through ASECT, which is the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. So there was a good amount of training through ASECT, which was like a third party. So I was doing training through ASECT. But my duties on the job were actually very fascinating. I worked for the corporate office of Pure Romance. So Pure Romance was, probably still is at the time, an in-home party plan company where the consultants go to the women's home and they do this fun little spiel about the sex toys. And then you can buy the sex toys right there in your own home, right? And so my job as working at corporate was to make sure that these consultants had good sex education, because what was happening is they were going in and they were selling their toys or whatever, but then in a one-on-one room, the women were coming up and saying, like, I'm actually experiencing vaginal dryness, or I have low libido, or things like that, right? And so my job was to make sure the consultants had good information to give them, like, oh, have you tried this, or maybe you need to go see an OB/GYN, or maybe you need to see a therapist, that kind of thing. So I'm developing trainings for, you know, I'm already an educator, so I'm developing trainings, which was right up my alley. So that's what I'm mostly doing, but I'm also on the product development team. So I'm also traveling to California to the sex toy companies to choose product. I'm also part of the naming convention team, which, by the way, there is a anal plug out there somewhere called Wild at Heart that I named after John Eldridge's Wild at Heart book that I hate. So just FYI, if you have that one, I named it. Thank you very much.
I won't expect the people to direct message me right away if they're like, hey, you know, I was listening to this. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. They might. It's an open forum here, right? So we had lubricant flavor conventions where we would go and taste all the lubricants and, you know, decide which new lubricant flavors we wanted to release that year. All kinds of, if you can think it, we probably did it. It was a wild company to work for. I will tell you that much. It was wild, but I did it and it launched my own career. So that's helpful.
So talk about that transition then, because you were there, right? It was your husband who was doing residency, right? In Columbus.
Yeah.
So when residency is done, how does that transition work for you? Because, okay, you're working in a certain industry, like, all right, now what do I want to do next? What was that transition period like for you?
Yeah. So it was actually before we moved. In 2012, I had the twins. So I have twin girls. They're 10 now, but I got pregnant with twins and I thought I was going to keep working, but it didn't end up, you know, I was driving 92 miles to work and working. I had to travel a lot for work and it just did not make sense for me to stay working in that job with, you know, having childcare for two kids is a lot. So I left work and I stayed home with the girls for about 18 months. And then I was getting real bored. And I needed to talk to some adults. And so I just came up with this idea, like, listen, I have a PhD, I have skill sets in behavior, I have all this information and training now in sex. I'm just gonna hang up a shingle. That's exactly what I did. I was like, I found a therapist who didn't work in her office for a couple of days a week, rented that office space for a couple of days and just said, okay, I'm going to help people with their sex life. That's literally what I did. I went and marketed at OB/GYN offices and at therapist offices and just slowly over time. But let me tell you, did I make maybe $47 my first year? Probably. But was I happy as a clam to be able to be doing my passion? I was absolutely so happy. So that's how it started. Was the when the girls were 18 months old, I was like, I need to talk to some adults.
Well, and that one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm going to be a sexologist. Hey, I'm going to help people. That's the easy part. The hard part is, a lot of people, even though they're sitting in front of you, are going to have a hard time talking about
it. Totally.
So to make the jump to say, you know, I think I want to go see somebody. So you mentioned OBGYN offices, which I have compassion. My dad was an OBGYN. So,
oh, cool. Of course,
so,
yeah.
So yeah. I was wondering, okay, how do you get word out, right? Because you also can't just go to Keene Church and go, hey guys, hey, I just want you know I'm starting a business.
Yep.
It's easier said than done. What were some of the breakthroughs that happened in order to get people initially going there?
Yeah, man, a lot of trial and error. I don't have a business degree. I don't have a marketing degree. I don't know what the heck I'm doing, right? And so I'm just like reading, you know, I probably got Tony Robbins' book or something. And I'm just like, okay, I guess I'm just gonna, you know, get a spiel, give an elevator speech, walk into these OB-GYN offices, and tell them that I can help them. Because what's happening, as you probably remember with your dad, is people are coming in there and saying they need help with their sex life. And an OB-GYN does not have the time or usually the skill set to be like, oh, here's the things that you need help with. Because a lot of them are just psychological, you know, trauma stuff, growing up in purity culture, all of those things are take weeks and time to kind of process through. And so I figured like, okay, if I can convince an OB-GYN that I can make their life better, I can, they'll probably send me some clients. Right. So that was how it began, but I'm still iterating on it. Right. I'm still like, I do get clients that see me on Instagram, but the most important part of my job is that you feel comfortable talking to me about your orgasm or your erectile dysfunction or whatever it is. And so my whole purpose on Instagram or through email is to help you feel comfortable, right? Because I don't get word of mouth referrals. I don't. People don't say like, hey, I'm seeing this great sexologist. You should go see them too, because people don't talk about their sex life with each other. So I'm constantly churning for new referrals off of the relationship that I can build with you over Instagram or email. And so that's how I do it mostly now. Because I'm established here in Fort Worth, most of the OB-GYNs around know now to refer to me if they need that kind of help, or to refer to any of the really great sexologists around. And so that's how it kind of works now. But at the beginning, I was just like, okay. And truth be told, I was going to churches because people in church really need help.
You're right. That may have bad example by me.
No. Just like you wouldn't think.
Right. You can't just get up and be like, hey, can we get this in the bulletin, please?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That in that manner is what I was meaning.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I would make like women's groups, not ladies' nights, where we would have a safe place to talk about what was, you know, going on. I do a lot of like anonymous questions on note cards where people can write their question and get it answered. And so that we can develop rapport and you can see how I would answer questions and how I might be able to help. So just a long process. I'm still learning new things about how to help people, and mostly how to help people feel comfortable in their own skin.
So now that you've been doing this for multiple years, for your parents and for your husband, family members,
yeah,
have they at any time, have you guys had to talk about like, okay, what did you think when I first started? Or have they mentioned, you know, at first I was like, I don't know, or what kind of discussions have you had with those three, yeah, at least over that time frame, right? Like the look where I've come from, or where they have expressed, man, I didn't know it was going to be like this, or I would have never guessed, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, we'll start with Nate Dogg because he, you know, was there from day one. And I do tell my story about, I did experience painful sex when we first got married, and I believe sex education really saved me in my relationship. And so there was some conversations like, how do you feel about me telling our story? I really, really focus on me because my husband is very private, and I definitely want to respect his privacy, but he's kind of just like, cool. He's kind of just like a calm dude. This is like, yeah, whatever. It's your story. Like, that's fine. If you want to share it, if it helps, he'll be like, if it helps us make some money, like tell your story. Right. And he also didn't grow up like in an environment where sex wasn't talked about. He doesn't carry sexual shame like I do, and a lot of us do that grew up in those environments. So I just think he's just like, okay, whatever. It's also really handy that he's an ER doctor. And so like, he sees a lot of things,
right.
Like he's not squeamish or, you know, particularly nervous about things that I might to say or talk about, because they're all just, it's just sex, right? And so he's always been so supportive and always been just like, hey, like, listen, you need to do what you're passionate about, and you're passionate about this and you're good at it. So like, all more power to you. And, you know, there's some funny jokes around. And then mom and dad have always been very supportive. I know that it's probably uncomfortable for them. My mom is just like, yeah, get it. Like, she's right. Like, you do you, like, you know, she loves it. She came to my last webinar, you know, she's awesome. I think daddy's a little bit more, he's a little bit more conservative. And so he's like, okay, well, no, all right. Well, that's interesting, you know? But definitely both very, very supportive, have always been supportive. And they might have discussions offline without me that I'm like, well, yeah, we don't know about this, but they don't share those with me, which is great parenting. And I've just always felt very supported in it. And maybe that's like rose colored glasses, but
no, because what you were saying about, I didn't think, like, you know, like I say, I don't know your husband, but I've met your parents multiple times and been around them before. And so I wouldn't think that they wouldn't be, but it's just different because you don't, you know, when people talk about careers, right? Like to say, oh yeah, you know, my son's doing this, my daughter's doing this, whatever, you know, it's just, I can imagine they've had some interesting conversations where someone asked them like, hey, what's Celeste doing now? Mm-hmm. You know? And I imagine I can't visualize your dad going, well, if you go to Instagram, you
know, like, probably not.
Right. But so those things, but the other part that comes into it is because of where you grew up and the area you grew up around, which I'm very familiar with that area.
Yes.
I imagine that the reaction from people you grew up around is different than your family's reaction initially. And you have to know that there are people that are going to say things away from you. But what were some of the more surprising reactions you remember having when you told either the people you grew up with or really conservative people you went to church with, like, hey, yeah, this is what I'm to see or know what they're like. Oh, yeah. Yes. You know, did they try to act cool, like normal, or were they curious, or what kind of reactions did you get?
I will tell you, I've gotten very, very few times in my life have I had somebody who's just like repulsed by my career. For the most part, people are like, wow, I didn't know that was a thing, right? People say that, oh, I've never met anybody who does this, or I didn't know that was a thing. And then it's like, yeah, I have some questions. Like normally that's what it is, because if you're confident, say like, yeah, I'm a sex educator, I help people with their sex lives. Mostly it's like, oh, maybe I could talk to her, you know, maybe she could answer this strange thing that's going on. Right. So mostly I just want to feel comfortable to people. And if I'm comfortable in my own career choices, then other people can feel more comfortable too. So I really haven't had that much of a reaction from friends or family or anything like that. I was always pretty loud in school already. So I don't think that's like, it's like not a far jump really for how I was in high school. Sometimes talking to strangers, like on a plane, typically men, if I'm with like sitting in a seat, and this is my favorite story. And the only time that I had a good response right away, I was sitting on a plane with somebody, and sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to tell them I'm a therapist or something. Right. I'm not going to go that far. But a guy was sitting next to me and he was just very insistent on talking to me. And so he's like, oh, what do you do? And I was like, oh, well, I'm a sex educator. I'm a sexologist. And he immediately was like, oh, what's your favorite position? And I just turned to him and I was like, CEO of my own company. That's my favorite position. And then I like put my headphones on and he never talked to me again. I was like, that's the one time I had something good to say. So, you know, there's some creepers out there, but mostly for the most part. And like, I have to give some compassion to that, right? Like we creep because we feel shame, right?
Yeah.
People are uncomfortable with sex or their own sexuality. And so they manifest it in different ways and are inappropriate with women or with people. And that comes from shame. So we can always find a sense of empathy or compassion, or at least it is my job to provide some compassion to all of those scenarios and situations.
Okay. Which brings us, speaking of scenarios and situations, to Instagram, because what your style is on Instagram is very unique, very different than the norm. And to me, I'm like, that's genius, because no one can come into this, like you mentioned already, your goal is to make people feel comfortable, because they have to feel comfortable if they're going to be sharing like their innermost secrets, or not secrets, just like things that are wrong, or they want to do better or be able to be better for their partner. But your Instagram videos, whether you're lip syncing, which you're very, very talented in lip syncing, whether
it's
lip syncing into
my
all sorts
dildos.
Of sexual devices, right?
Like, yes.
And adding humor from the beginning, have you felt like that has been a big, important part of you being able to help new people that come in to you that might find out about you from Instagram?
I really think it has. I wouldn't have guessed that at the beginning. And the beginning of my Instagram was pretty like tiled and like very traditional, you know? And then about a year and a half ago, I was like, I'm going to try being sarcastic, or I'm going to try like make like double entendres, making something that's not sexual, right? Because that's my whole job. and I still have like the brain of like a 12-year-old boy. So I was like, I'm just going to give this a try and see what happens. Never thinking that it would be anything other than fun for me. I was like, I just want to have some fun, right? And it has been really helpful, actually. I'll have people who do discovery calls and say, like, I saw you on Instagram and I felt like I could talk to you. And that is like the biggest compliment to all of those silly reels and videos. And people are going to bash social media until the end of time. It's not going away, right? It's something that we can use, in my opinion, for good. Instagram has helped me a lot in struggling with anxiety or struggling with grief or things like that, you know, following certain accounts that help me. Oh man, I think about this differently now, you know, and help you reframe. So that's what I want for the account, is to help somebody think about it a little bit differently, or just to take the awkwardness down a notch. You know, we don't have to feel awkward about penises and vulvas and things like that, you know, especially if you are exposed to forms of them on a platform that feels safe. So you're exposed to like the blue plastic vulva that I have, then it's like, okay, that's one more level of comfort that I can have with my own vulva or my own penis or with my partners or whatever. So that's my whole goal, is just like helping people feel more comfortable through humor, through reframing, things like that.
And then you mentioned webinars earlier, your mom coming to your last one. You know, you're involved with a business in the Fort Worth area, the Velvet Box.
Yeah.
Just give a brief explanation of how did that come about and how do you integrate that with everything else that you do?
We'd been living in Fort Worth for a few years, and I knew I liked the company, the Velvet Box, better than any of the adult toy stores around, because they were doing education. They had educated staff. They picked product that I felt was high quality. And so I knew I wanted to be involved with them somehow, but I wasn't sure how. And at the time I had a radio show called Let's Talk About Sex at RIP Radio. and so I asked if they would want to be a sponsor, and they could have one show a month where we would just talk about their sex toys and things like that. And so that's how I developed the relationship. And then over time, I started teaching classes for them and became one of their sex educators. And now I'm their lead sex educator. I teach all of their sex education classes, which are really fun. They're just really, really fun and helpful. And yes, we talk about product, but we're talking about skill sets like oral sex, skill sets like getting pregnant, you know, things that we just don't have a lot of approachable, accessible education about. Like, you know, if you want to learn how to do a skill set, you're either watching porn and some people aren't comfortable with that, or you're reading a book and that's not super helpful. So we want to provide education that's accessible, that's not intimidating, that is real, that's not like, you know, porn just gives us a kind of inflated sense of what's possible. And that's just really helpful and connective. So it felt like a beautiful next step to be in partnership with Marcel, who's the owner, and her company, which I really, really love.
Now, when you do webinars, what would you say for the people that come to them, or like I say, it could be webinars or any online stuff you've done, what would you say is the most interesting characteristic trait that you have seen, whether that be age, whether that be personality, whether that be lifestyle? What is something that has been like, wow, okay, that's really interesting, as far as dealing with the people that have come to any of those?
That's a really good question. I think that culturally, we consider sexy to be young, white, and thin. And it's very helpful when we see the people showing up that are not young, white, and thin. And that's most of the people, right? So we are acculturized to think because of what we see in media, because we don't see normal people having sex, right? Sex is the one thing that we don't see people doing, right? We're modeled driving behavior. We're modeled relationship behavior. We're modeled eating behavior. We're modeled exercise behavior. We are not modeled sex behavior. So the only sex we ever see is on media or pornography. And typically those bodies are going to look a very certain Eurocentric way. And so being able to see the people that come up to classes or to know that we're serving a bigger audience and that we can provide imaging if we do something, we usually don't provide imaging, but sometimes we can provide imaging of people that don't look like that, that you typically see in media, is really helpful. And I feel like is one of the things that a lot of people have kind of mentioned, like, oh, I don't have to be thin to enjoy sex because it's about my body sensations. It's not about what I look like. Sexy is an attitude, not a visual appeal. So, you know, just breaking some of those cultural stereotypes down is really helpful and one of the most fun things about my job, I think.
Totally. I love the explanation because if you tell me, hey, what's the most important class in high school? I'm going to tell you physical education, but, yeah. But truly health and sex ed to me is the most important topic. And the yes. problem is, and like I say, this is not a Texas thing. This is not a California thing. This is an everywhere in the United States thing. Mm. Most schools either have dropped health education completely or expect it to be taught over a 2-week time frame. Yet that is something that people are going to deal with their entire lives. They'll need it literally from the minute, well, shoot, while they're in high school, middle school, high school, all the way through. And I don't see a perfect answer, right? Because as you talked about purity culture, right? If it's a private school and someone comes in teaching, someone's going to complain. If it's a public school, someone's going to complain. We know that different levels of political nature will complain about anything no matter what.
Right.
But it's like, yeah, this is something that no one says isn't important, but yet there's always disagreement on, well, how do you get the word out? And I don't know what specific situations you've dealt with, but it just seems like a losing battle for teens in that how are they supposed to learn if you don't want us to tell them, yet you don't want them to learn on social media, but that's all they're going to do because right. what other option do they have? I don't know the correct way to fix that. What are some ways that you have or ideas that you have that it possibly could change?
Yeah. And I'm glad that you've already talked to Janelle because her line of work is similar and different in that she's educating parents a lot of the times about teaching kids about sex, which I think, like anything, is going to take a multifaceted approach to create sexually healthier generations, right? And so my approach in my practice is if we can take your sexual shame as an adult and remove it or take it down multiple notches, you are breaking generational shame around sex, and you will be able to talk to your own kid more vulnerably, more honestly, more transparently about sex, right? And so that's my approach, is helping individuals break their own cycles of shame and pass less shame on to their kids, right? So we know, studies indicate that a kid needs one trusted adult in their life. Doesn't even have to be a parent, but is most likely to be a parent or a caregiver. One trusted adult that they can go to with their sex questions or questions about drugs and alcohol, right? So if you have that one trusted adult in your life that you can go to, you have better health outcomes, better sexual health outcomes. You make better and more healthier decisions, right? And so if that trusted adult is saying like, hey, here's the information, here's what I think about the information, and you're going to make your own decisions about this information, and I'm here to support you, whatever it is, right? Then that kid has the tools to make better health and healthier and more informed choices about sex. So in my opinion, the work is for caregivers. And we can develop curriculum all day long in schools, which is incredibly important. And I'll tell you one story in a second about why that's important. But if it's not coming from a trusted adult, right, it might fall on deaf ears. But sex education in school is so important. Here, I'll give you an example. And listen, when you sit in this chair, you hear a lot of really awful, awful, awful things. And just if somebody is listening is like, I'm not super sure about sex education, remember somebody who maybe is being sexually abused from age 2 or second grade to sixth grade, but doesn't know what's happening and doesn't understand that as something that shouldn't be happening or wrong, right? Gets to sixth grade, has sex education, and then stands up to her abuser and says, oh, you can't do this to me anymore, right? Sex education saved her from more abuse. And so I hear that story multiple times a week, right? In some form or fashion. So sex education isn't like a nice to have. It is literally saving our kids. So I'm a little passionate about it. and just if we can think more about what it's giving our kids versus what somehow we think is taking away. I hear this a lot. I don't want my kids' innocence to be taken away, but information doesn't make you guilty, right? Just like lack of information doesn't make you innocent. Right. So work on your own sexual shame, promotes, you know, legislation and policy that promotes sex education in schools. And the next generation is better. The next generation is better. They're making better sexual choices. They are more informed and they're more accepting and more affirming than any generation before us. So it's good news, but it's got to keep working.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The more affirming and more caring, you know, I can state that I'm around high school students 9.5 months a year, right? And that is the hope for the future, because most of these students, children, whatever you want to call them, are being, no matter what's happening in their home from their moms and dads, that they are coming up with that, I care about you no matter how you are, no matter who you are. And yes, there's always going to be doofuses, like we know that. But there's much more of acceptance now, which I think is so, like, we know it's important no matter where you're at. But if that younger generation doesn't have that, then they're not going to change when they get to be 30, right? Then I'm right. Like, oh yeah, now I'll accept you, of course. Right. But okay, so we've talked about all these different things, and the topics of this podcast is so great. It's like literally two things no one wants to talk about: death,
yes,
and sex together, all in one. So if anybody's ever going to be nervous before listening to anything, hey, we got it all for you right here. But just briefly give out your information, because even though you are located in the great state of Texas, it doesn't mean that people from outside the state cannot get in touch with you or cannot refer people to you. So let's go Instagram first and then website. How do we find you?
Yes. And yes, so I do virtual consults. So I work with couples and individuals about a bunch of sex topics like low libido and sexual shame and sexual pain. So you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Celeste Holbrook. That's Dr. Celeste Holbrook. And you can find my website, drcelesteholbrook.com. Or you can email me at info@drcelesteholbrook.com. So any of those.
And your website is great. It has all talks you've done. I still can't believe you did one at Southwestern. That was impressive to me.
I think and Loma Linda.
Yeah. Well, the Loma Linda one, I'm less surprised by, right? Because I was just like, man, that's impressive. That you worked at Southwestern, which of course is a small Adventist college in Keene, Texas, that we both attended. So yes, we have history there. Now I did tell you, and I don't want to forget this before we finish here, that if you have any questions for me, it could be anything, it could be whatever, but I always want to make sure that whoever I am talking to has the opportunity, if they want to ask me something, they can. Cause I don't know. I love answering questions, but I also don't want someone feeling like it's always coming one direction. So this is why. So is there anything that you have for me here today?
I do. Actually, I thought about this because And we touched on it just briefly, just a second ago, but I want to know what has changed for you personally, as you think about people's health journey and you're teaching health, physical education to high school students. Have you seen like the arc of body positivity go to body neutrality? Do you see that with the girls that you're working with, or the boys that you're working with, or the whomever you're working with? Like, can you tell me some arcs that you've seen? Because it's still like health education is still my passion, even though I'm in the specific field of sex. I'm curious to see what's changed since I was in kind of the field of public health specifically to now. Like, do you feel like your teaching philosophy has changed as time has gone on and we've kind of learned more about social determinants of health and what actually affects people's health outcomes?
So, two parts of this. Number one, like, this is the differentiation, because and this is part of what I try to explain to people, is because growing up in a small, if it's a small town or a private school, people automatically put health and PE together, which they kind of used to be. But in the state of California, shoot, it was like right around 2000, they separated health and PE completely, to where you have to have a credential for one. They don't intertwine, right? Like, gotcha. You could get both, but they're not. You get one, you get the other. Okay. Gotcha. But this is what's so important, is because they are not the same thing, right? Health is one thing. Physical education is another thing. But I champion health immensely, even though I'm not necessarily teaching that. But your question is great, because I get to see all types of bodies changing, growing, whether it's boys from their sophomore year that are 5'8", that are 6'4" by their senior year, right? Or it's girls that are becoming stronger if they're an athlete, or just natural changes. And sometimes it's unhealthy ones, right? Like, the big one now is vaping, right? Like, literally you'll see a kid that drops 20 pounds in a year, and I know why. Yeah. And I can't understand why the rest of their family members don't know why necessarily. Gotcha. So you see those things too, because what I get to see, body types, body styles, body movement all the time. And to see people, are they comfortable in their own skin, right? Are they getting more comfortable in their own skin? And it's really interesting, because, for instance, our PE shorts, okay? This is just a small example. We used to only have the long PE shorts.
Yeah.
Some schools still do. I'm sure there's some people who can listen to this and go, what? So, long PE shorts. Well, then, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, workout clothes have changed, right? Like, short shorts are back for females, for males, for any person of any orientation. That has become more of a style that is in. And my philosophy for physical education is, I want the students to not worry about what they're wearing. Like, of course, you have PE clothes for PE in high school, but I don't want them to be hung up on that. So whatever they got to have that we can offer them that's going to make them feel comfortable, because I don't want them worrying about that, right? Like, they have 23 hours of the rest of the day that they might worry about, like, how do I look? How do I, you know, what do I look like in this? I don't want them worrying about that, or thinking like, oh, I would play harder, but, you know, in the body comp. So we started getting some companies or offered the shorter shorts for PE. Mm-hmm. So my initial reaction was, we have to have them. As an option, right? Like, because I want students, number one, some people aren't going to feel comfortable wearing that, right? No problem. You can wear the longer ones. But there are some people that, like, that is so body affirming for them to wear the shorter shorts. If they were working out away from school, they'd be wearing that. So all those things play into, I want students to feel the most comfortable they possibly can. And if they feel like, awesome, man, I can show, what's up? This is my leg.
Sure,
Or if they're like, hey, I'd rather have it covered in long shorts. In high school, I had a thing about my knees, so I would only wear long shorts. And I think about that, I'm like, what a doofus. That's like, what so was funny, I doing? Right? Like, yeah. I just thought my knees looked funny. And so it had nothing to do with my legs or my calves. I thought my knees looked weird. And so I sometimes will think, like, I wonder if, does this student have anything they're dealing with? But my goal in everything is, I essentially want them to be the best possible version of themselves they can, while understanding that 14 to 18 is a really huge time changing part of your life. But whatever it may be, I want you to get the most out of yourself while I have you in class. Now, from a physical standpoint, but I do think that there is less, I don't know. I think the body types, because of social media, I think it's only helping for the most part, right? There's still some idiot things you see where people are like, oh, you have to be skinny or you should look like this. Right. But I feel like it's as good as it's ever been as far as where guys, girls, you know, even some students that are, whether it's changing gender or in the midst of not knowing what they're going to do, to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And there's less talking about it now. So at least where I'm at now, I'm in California, right? Northern California, which is going to be considered way less conservative than some other areas in the country, right?
Sure.
But I do feel it's a more positive time, and that students are able to feel better about themselves. And I, like I say, I can't go into class talking about body types and body styles, right?
Of course, I can't
do that. But in conversations with students, which I can have, I really try to, if I sense that the person is like not sure of themselves, whether it be a physical standpoint with their body or how they are playing something, I always want to give them like, hey, you be you, like, it's okay. Like, and if you're great at something, don't be afraid. Like, and so the same concept, like I say, I don't ever say, hey, I want you to put on whatever you need to put on to look your best, to do what you need to do. But that's the whole goal, right? Like, create the best person you can create. And PE is not all about PE. It's so much about relationship and dealing with people and understanding personalities and dealing with personalities and yet in a competitive environment. So I do think we're in a more positive time frame for teens, at least being open to, oh, cool, it's okay to be muscular, right? Because that was the thing, you know, I think that when girls, it would be looked at like, oh, if a girl has muscles, like, that's odd, right? And it's like, so what? Like, that's okay. You know, and then I have had some students over time, some of them athletes, some of them not, where I can tell they're proud of like, yeah, what's up? You know?
Yeah.
This is me. Yeah.
This is who I am. Yeah. I'm so happy to hear you say that you feel like it's gotten better because of social media, because sometimes I'm like, am I too Pollyanna? But I'm, and I do curate my social media to be what I, you know, I'm confirmation bias. Like, I see the things that I want to see, but I see so many bodies represented doing awesome stuff, you know? And I didn't have that as a kid. I had like the Victoria's Secret fashion show. And if you weren't Kate Moss, you know, thin, then you were nothing. Right. And so I feel so happy for the kids who can see bodies like theirs doing really phenomenal stuff. And I think that's so helpful and good. And yes, as you say, there's, you know, bad parts of social media too, that are going to be edited and all this stuff. But I think that there's so much that's very, very helpful for them too. I'm really happy to hear you say that. And I love your philosophy. I think that's, you're an amazing educator for sure.
Well, no, thank you. But now is there anything you thought of today? Any other question you have before we finish out here, anything else I can answer for you? Cause I don't want you to feel come away and say, oh, well, you know, I would be more thankful this year if I had.
I just want, can we talk again? I want to do this
more. Yes, for sure. So that was what I was gonna say at the end, is that I always find myself wondering, because I have classes where there might be literally 20 cultures in a class of like 45 kids, which is awesome. But then I always will think like, okay, I wonder how they're being brought up. And yeah, and I don't always think like, I wonder if their parents talk to them about sex or that kind of thing. But every culture is so different, right? Every family is so different. And we don't know. I think sometimes we get stuck into thinking like, oh, well, they'll figure it out. Well, people will only figure stuff out if they're brought to it. And who is it that's telling them? I'd rather someone who's educated telling them something than Johnny, who changes in the locker next to him going, hey, here's how it works. Like, no, I don't want Johnny telling, you know, students like, yeah, this is how it works, when I know Johnny can't even think straight, like 10 feet. Right. So those kind of things I always am wondering about, but I just know how important it is. So yes, we definitely have to talk again. I have some ideas for the future that we could do some different things, but I just want to say thank you so much for being, you know, people don't know, but to be willing to talk about death with family members, it is not simple to do, but man, like for me, I relate to you in that I always feel like listen, I'll talk about that stuff whenever, wherever. It's like, I know that it's usually the other person who feels more odd, right? Like afraid to ask questions or things like that. But I'm so thankful that you were willing to let me talk a little bit about Devin and then for you to talk, because I knew that that would add in understanding to see just your entire life structure come into play a little bit. But thank you so much, Celeste.
Oh, wow. It was, I can really say it's been, I think, my very, very favorite podcast because you are so, obviously easy to talk to, but then like having rapport, knowing Devin made it really such a good experience for me. Like part of healing, and you're always healing from grief, right? You're always in a process of management, at least not healing, but at least management. It's so lovely to get to kind of almost go in order and like, what did happen and what was I feeling? Because I don't think that I've ever processed that with somebody who knew Devin. So I appreciate you being able to hold space for me to cry and to be, you know, sad, and also to rejoice in, you know, the fun parts of who Devin's personality was. So I really appreciate it. It was really, really special, Mike. Thank you very much for having me.
And that is going to do it for today. Once again, a humongous thanks to Celeste Holbrook for joining us on this episode, being willing to bear her heart and talk about her life. And for those of you who know about Celeste, she's been on tons of other podcasts. And in those, she's talking about, you know, her work and how she does things. But the perspective I wanted to give you in this episode obviously was very different. And as she mentioned, she was talking about things she's never talked about before. But it's awesome because I know that you really know her after listening to this. And many of you may want to reach out to her. So once again, let's get her information. You heard her say her Instagram, Dr. Celeste Holbrook, Dr. Celeste is C-E-L-E-S-T-E, and then Holbrook, H-O-L-B-R-O-O-K. So Instagram, Dr. Celeste Holbrook. On the web, it's drcelesteholbrook.com. Very simple. And if you want to email her through the website or through not the website, it's info@drcelesteholbrook.com. If you want to talk to us here on the podcast or me, get in touch, you can. The email for the podcast is still the same. It's themicison@gmail.com. That's the M-I-C is A-H-N at gmail.com. And of course, on Instagram, it's AniBPE, A-H-N-I-E-B-P-E. As you heard, once again, Celeste wants to come back to the podcast, so at some point she will be there. But please let your friends know. Let anybody who you think will be entertained by what you just heard, because as I promised beforehand, it's something different. It's storytelling, it's life talking, and something that was meaningful, obviously, to Celeste and I, but hopefully to many of you out there as well. If you have fallen behind listening to episodes of the podcast, remember, they're all evergreen, so that's okay. As we like to say, you aren't behind, you're just not caught up yet. So get caught up, and we will see you later. Thank you.